entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Why, indeed it is. The best of Downtown, to be specific. Hello there. And a very good Sunday morning to you on this, the 12th day of the month of May. A happy Mother's Day to you as well. If that applies, if it doesn't, go share it with a mom nearby and tell them it's from Kimball and Haskell. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell with you on a Sunday morning for the best of Downtown, brought to you as the program is each weekday by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Good stuff, wide variety of things this morning as we revisit three recent conversations, including the always fun and entertaining David Roth of Deadspin. First time with us, but also fun and entertaining, Scottish singer-songwriter Al Stewart, he of the Year of the Cat. But as we found out, Al Stewart much more than the Year of the Cat. And we begin things this morning with a very funny guy, an author, humorist, a panelist for NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We had a chance to catch up recently with a very funny Tom Baudet.
Well, hey, Rich, thanks for having me. I do appreciate it.
Been a fan of your work for a long, long time, and I want to go back to almost the beginning here. You're building houses in Homer, Alaska, back in the day. How did NPR learn about you, and how did that connection get established?
Well, I was doing these local commentaries on the local news at our little public radio station there, KBBI, for a while, just for fun. A buddy of mine worked at the station, and they found their way down through the hands of a couple Alaska producers to All Things Considered in Washington, and the next thing I know, you know, here was a whole new life for me, which was better than the old one somehow.
Well, yeah, and not long after that, the folks from a little motel chain worked out. That connection has served you both pretty well through the years.
Can you believe it's 32 years this year that since we started doing that? It's, yeah, I did that for the money once in 1986, and it's just become this amazing, long, and wonderful ride. I'm a very fortunate guy.
Now, the story I read on the unimpeachable source, Wikipedia, said that they liked you because you sounded like someone who might stay at a Motel 6. Is that right?
Well, that was said to me at that time. I do remember I said, when I was asking all the questions at the beginning of it all, like, you know, how much and things like that. I said, and why me? And they said, well, you do sound like the kind of person who stays there. And all I could say back is, well, I am the kind of person who stays there. So that worked.
Fantastic. Now, what led you to go from one side of the country to the other?
Well, that was more of family matters. My wife, Rita, was pregnant with who would be the first grandchild on her side of the family. And her family was all out in the east here. And so somehow that was enough gravitational pull to get me away from Alaska and into the loving arms of family. And I got to say, living in Vermont as we have now for the last 16 years has been another wonderful and unexpected surprise and a gift to my life.
Well, a gift to all of us is Saturdays on NPR, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You are the third panelist to be on our show. Amy Dickinson, Paula Poundstone has been on with us a bunch of times. Now, Paula insists that for all the time she's been on, that she has almost never won. Is she exaggerating a little?
Almost never is very accurate. never is exaggerating because she has won a time or two. But the reason for that is not because Paula Poundstone, as you well know, is in any way dim-witted or uninformed. But Paula is a true professional in that if you ask her a question and she thinks of something that's funnier than the answer, you're going to get the laugh before you get the answer.
Now, is it true that everything is unscripted on Wait, Wait?
Yes, that's true. Everything the panelists do, the only thing we know going out there is that bluff, the listener question from the night before, and we are able to write those, of course, before the show starts. But all of the other questions and the stuff that comes our way is that's the first time we hear it. It's an awful lot of fun.
We're talking with Tom Beaudet here on Downtown. We've all got our favorite Tom Beaudet work, but my producer, Carrie, especially loves your work on Animaniacs.
Oh, yeah. She must be, what, about 35?
I'm actually a little older than that. I'm 50, but yeah, I was.
But he's young at heart.
I'm young at heart, and I was a huge fan of that old style animation that Animaniacs brought back. And your good idea, bad idea bits were just hilarious.
Yeah, that was the most fun I've ever had working during that series for them. They were having so much fun. And I would go down to L.A. To the studio. You know, it was a Spielberg production and Warner Brothers animation. And it was just such a wonderful, wonderful time. And it's the only thing. My son, my oldest son, was in the sixth grade. That's right. And I was doing something that made me cool.
You've also got a really wonderful project that you're involved in right now in Brattleboro, Vermont, Hatch Space, a nonprofit woodworking school and community shop. I was reading about it over the weekend. This just sounds like a wonderful opportunity for all kinds of different people in your community.
Yeah, well, it's what it is our intention with it is to bring people who into the world of woodworking and woodworking because that's what we know. My partners and I have been woodworkers all our lives, and the real point of it is to get people making things with their hands, working together, and building community around something other than our glowing screens or you know, things such as that. Maybe it's old school thinking, but I really believe we're at our best when we're talking to each other face to face and sharing something that we've done ourselves.
And it sounds like it's a kind of space where people can learn woodworking, but also have access to perhaps the kind of tools they don't have in their own home shops.
Yeah, that's right. We have a lot of people involved with us who are, you know, seasoned professionals who maybe need a 44-inch wide belt sander once a year, and they're going to come down and be in our shop because we've got one of those. And hopefully while they're there, they'll be able to interact with some of our less experienced members, and everybody learns a little bit from each other.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Now, you're also involved in local government there in Vermont. How has that experience been for you?
Well, it was a great experience. I was on the Dummerston Select Board for 7 years, which was really, it wasn't as much fun as Animaniacs, but almost as silly sometimes. And I enjoyed it very much. I'm no longer on the select board, but I expect I will get back to it one day. It's, you know, Vermont, like Maine, you know, we're a very rural state, and the towns still have, a good measure of control over, solve a few problems.
Well, we wish you continued success in everything you do, Tom. We've been fans of your work for a whole lot of years. It's great to have you on with us this afternoon. Thanks so much for being with us, and hope to do it again sometime.
Well, and thanks for having me, and I apologize I had to do this while driving. I appreciate your listeners having patience for that. Thank you, everybody.
That is Tom Beaudet leaving the light on for us here on Downtown on this Sunday morning. When we come back, David Roth of Deadspin covers, as he usually does, quite a bit of ground here on Downtown on Z62.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Spring is here, and that means biking season. And the experts at Slipping Gears have just what you need. They're the area's premier full-service bike shop, located at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. With outstanding service and a huge stock, they've got the parts, accessories, and the expert advice you need, as well as the fastest repairs around and a great selection of new bikes. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, Saturdays, 9 to 5, and you can shop online anytime at slippinggears.com. Slipping Gears, 753 Stillwater Avenue, Bangor.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With the network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Pretty sure this should be considered a public service announcement. So in advance, you're welcome. I just went to the Ground Round in Bangor and had the most amazing food from their special menu. First, I got the Reuben Egg Rolls, which is all the flavors of the classic Reuben sandwich wrapped in a crispy egg roll and served with savory garlic smoky paprika sauce that has this slight kick. It's so good. To go with it, I ordered the Memphis Fries, French fries loaded with pulled pork, drizzled with barbecue sauce, topped with chopped pickles and diced onions. If your mouth is watering right now, head to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
Success. For some, it's the result of luck. For the Maine Black Bears, it's the result of planning, determination, and hard work. Success may have brought you financial rewards, and now in many ways, life isn't simpler, it's more complex. Your choices impact more people and can have longer lasting effects than ever before. At ClearPoint Financial, we understand your challenges. We can help navigate today's changing financial landscape and help you pursue your financial goals. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. See what ClearPoint Financial can do for you. Call us today at 307-7718.
Back on your Sunday morning, the best of downtown. I'm Rich Kimble. He's Kerry Haskell. You know who you are, sure, even on a Sunday morning. We look back at recent conversations. This one from just about a week ago. Always fun to catch up with David Roth of Deadspin. Well, we covered a lot of ground from basketball to who would direct a movie about the Trump years. We covered it all with David Roth here on Downtown.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm outstanding. You are the people's choice. Congratulations on a tremendous run all the way to the Funky Four in this year's Downtown Madness, even over your protests.
I'm happy that you brought it up because I kept thinking about ways that I would accidentally bring up my run to the Final Four, but you doing it on purpose makes it seem weird. Yeah, that still is mind-boggling to me, but I'm very much in your listener's debt. That was really nice.
People love you on the show, and a little cash doesn't hurt either.
Yeah. Wait, did I win something?
Oh, no. I paid them cash to vote for you. And
oh,
then, you know,
all right, cool. Yeah, I was like, wow, this is exciting. You could have, if you'd mailed a Home Depot gift card to my home, it would have been, more than enough.
We'll send you down.
That was really nice.
We'll send you a downtown T-shirt. We can do that.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
You wear that with pride.
I don't have much use for a Home Depot, to be honest.
Right. You wear that T-shirt in the streets of New York, boy, people are going to look.
I think, yeah, there's probably more of a brand presence here than we know, but I'm happy to draw their fire and then have people gloat on Alan Adams' behalf right in my face.
Now, I think, sadly, though, the last one I gave out to a guest was to Susan Collins, and yeah, I want it back at this point, so I'm not sure how that's working out.
Hey, what is the backseas policy on this? I'm trying to think of what I would have to do in order to just have to mail you your... At least she gets to take votes. I would just have to become a really obnoxious...
That would work. So much to talk about today. I hope you've got some time, because I have an agenda. Well, I always have an agenda here today, but I want to start with the fact that Trump's party for the Baylor women's basketball team somehow took you back to having brisket with your grandparents' neighbors. I love that connection.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's probably unfair to Philly and Ruth, who really were very nice people and lived next door to my grandma and certainly cared more about feeding me than my grandma did. They just didn't really care enough to ask whether I liked brisket before they started giving it to me. And that became, just a solid decade of my life of eating brisket while people nodded approvingly, being like, oh, he's doing a good job, chewing it. I didn't think that was going to be my lot when I was 10 years old. But I think mostly the connection there. I think that food was certainly better than the like room temp Chick-fil-A that Trump served to the Baylor women. I'd have to imagine. I mean, you know, the congealed meat, the debate that's roiled food communities for time immemorial.
And they look so happy to be there and enjoying that spread. It was like a hostage video.
The different tweets and the videos that all the players were putting out where they, you know, they win a championship. This is a peak moment in anybody's athletic career. And then some guy who keeps getting their names wrong is like, oh, I got some Burger King. It's been there for 48 hours. And you have to be like, thanks. The way that anybody drew it up, I'm sure.
You wouldn't do this for Gino Auriemma, by God.
I feel like you wouldn't because Gino would put you on blast. I feel like in a lot of ways, like the, you could, one of the real great tensions, and there's a 10-minute video from C-SPAN of Trump doing his thing where he reads off a piece of paper and then periodically ad-libs a few varies and so many are telling these into the text. But he keeps trying to banter with Kim Mulkey, who is the extremely no-nonsense coach of Baylor. And she's extremely not having it. Like, she's very polite. Like, this is very much like a, you know, high-powered Texas lady who is in the Oval Office and not for the first time. But, yeah, the had some real, like, you remember, like, the UK version of The Office?
Yes.
Like, it was kind of, like, the American one was much warmer. Everybody was much nicer. This was some real Ricky Gervais vibes. And, you know, if that's the sort of anti-comedy you're into, I really recommend the video.
That was great. So you were, for one day, the hypothetical NBA commissioner, David, and you went with a four-point shot as your big change to the operation.
Yeah, that was this is a new video idea that Dan McQuaid, my coworker, had. And Dom Cosentino went on the first one and made what I think was actually a very good suggestion, which was that teams could get an extra point if on the kickoff, the kicker successfully boots the ball through the uprights. That would be fun to watch. I got on the subway to go down and shoot the video with basically no ideas in my head at all. And the four-point shot seemed better. I originally had some stuff about we're going to change draft eligibility or whatever. But I figured if the concept is you only get one day as GM and then you can't really be around for the repercussions of whatever bad idea you have, that you might as well go for the gusto. And so the four-point shot was born.
Go big or go home. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it was. Do you remember the Rock and Jock games that MTV used to have? That was basically where the idea came.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I mean, that's not the ideal model for anything because it was basically like Joey Lawrence missing reverse layups in like 1993. Whatever, anything that could be considered a glory day for the sport. But, you know, my mind goes where it goes.
As a reformed New York Football Giants fan, two words, Daniel Jones. You saw this coming, huh?
Yeah, feels great. This is definitely one of those things that I sometimes will periodically predict something, never because I'm actually prescient or am well-sourced. I want to make clear that that is never the case. It's just that sometimes I think of what the worst but also funniest thing that could happen might be. And then if it feels right, I sort of believe it's going to happen. I sort of felt like that with Trump getting elected president. I definitely felt like that in terms of the Giants taking Daniel Jones, just because they seem to want, like, there's a certain type of, like, chin-mouth thing that they're looking for quarterbacks. They want them a little jowly. They want them breathing through their mouth. And I think in Jones, they found a suitable successor to Eli in that regard, and maybe only that regard.
It's fantastic. somebody tweeted, so for the successor to Eli Manning, the Giants have gone with the less charming Eli Manning.
Oh, gosh. And I feel terrible for Jones in some ways because it's like he's just a guy, you know, like, as is Eli. I mean, he's just kind of, if you saw Eli on the street, you would be like, that guy's like the fifth best attorney in an eighth attorney firm, you know, like, not a very imposing dude. And Jones is kind of like a similar vibe, but I mean, now he has to come in and everybody's already mad at him. And like, I sort of feel bad for him now. We'll see how I feel once I start watching him, you know, whatever, throw 4-yard checkdowns every play next year. But
like, he walks into a room and people say, oh, You played at Duke. Great. Yeah, yeah. Football. Football, though. Oh,
right.
Football.
Yeah, I was like, wow, what's Coach K like? Oh, I saw him. On the quad. Shorter than you'd think. Yeah.
He seemed busy. Always seemed busy.
Yeah.
You are...
A Duke quarterback of my youth, too. The Giants drafted a guy named Dave Brown.
That's right. The last time they did it, back in the early 90s, I think.
And they were real proud of themselves then, too. They were like, you wouldn't believe how smart this guy is. Like, he was just rattling off the times table. And then, like, 4 years later, he's a real estate agent in North Jersey. And, like, shows how that goes.
There's your future, Daniel Jones. Good luck with that. I'm glad to hear that you continue to be absolutely enthralled with the Stanley Cup playoffs.
I'm doing my best. I feel bad, but we do, a Deadcast episode on it every year. And Drew is better at, he will parachute in during the playoffs, decide on a team that he likes, or, because he lives near D.C., cheer for the Caps, and attack it earnestly. Hockey was one of the first cuts when I started making these strategic decisions to not pay less attention to sports, but to pay the same amount of attention to fewer sports.
Right.
And so I'm well behind the curve on that. And Lauren Tyson, who's one of our resident hockey knowers at Deadspin, came on the podcast and educated me not just on which teams I should cheer for, but like the fact that the Winnipeg Jets are back, for instance. They're back in the NHL, which I think is great. Columbus has a team, Ohio, and they're fairly good.
And you don't like their logo, right?
I don't care for the logo. It seems like the fan culture there is cool. The last hockey story I wrote a million years ago is about a guy dances at their games. And he was a super sweet guy, and I had a great time with the story. And I've always had a soft spot for them since. I had not paid attention to their logo, and it looks like I'm trying to think of what it is. Like when you're on the highway, and sometimes you have to go to one of those like TA rest stop things.
Yeah.
It looks both like the logo for those rest stops and then also like something that you would get on a t-shirt or a hat at one of those rest stops.
Remember that time we went through that rest stop? Yeah, yeah, they got the t-shirt. Still in the drawer.
Right. Right. Anyway, yeah, so they're on to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Congratulations to your t-shirt that just says America on it.
There you go. I see that your mayor is contemplating going the John Lindsay route. I hate this stinking job. Is there one job out there that could be worse than being mayor of New York? Yes.
It's incredible. I love him. Bill de Blasio, America's sweetheart, and my mayor. I don't see him around very much. He kind of has been avoiding New York for like 18 months, which, if I could leave for 18 months, I probably would too, if I'm being honest. But I'm not the mayor, and he is, and that's a crucial difference. And he's really squandered a lot of goodwill by not showing up at work since like 2017. The fact that he now wants to be president of the United States is so mind-boggling to me that I almost find it inspiring. Like, I think in a month it will have come all the way around, and I'll be like, bless his heart. Like, he's living his dream.
I'm looking for, frankly, the three or four people who hold public office currently who don't aspire to be the next president.
It is pretty interesting. I mean, this is like, he would be the 21st official candidate for the Democratic nomination, right?
At least, yeah.
That's a lot. That's like a few more of those, and you have to start like designating guys for assignment when new ones come up.
Right, right.
Like, that's not how you're supposed to do it. Like, the idea, I mean, for some of them, it just seems like a way to, maybe they don't want to run for the Senate. I wouldn't want to be in the Senate either. It seems like a terrible job. Coworkers are lousy. And the hours are bad. And the idea of, maybe you think you've got a shot. Who's to say that you can't be president when you consider that there's like a racist game show host that's literally the president of the United States right now. But, man, I think you got to draw the line somewhere. And I think maybe it's Bill de Blasio, the Red Sox fan living under an assumed name who never takes the subway and is the mayor of New York City. Like, that might be too weird. It might be that is weirder than Trump being president.
Well, if you make your announcement and your best hope is that you make the preliminary debate, because you're not going to make the cut for the big one.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There are going to be those again.
Oh, of course, yeah.
The Republican side in 2016, the ones that are, it's like, you know, like doors open at 3, like first debate starts at 4, actual debate starts at 7.
Yeah, this, it's the warm-up, it's the undercard.
It is. It's like the guy that comes out before, like, a late-night taping. It's like, anybody here from out of town? Except for, like, that's Representative Eric Swalwell. It's really great.
And the guy was the guy from Delaware who's not even in Congress anymore, but remembers that it used to be a pretty good gig.
It's incredible. Yeah, there's the ones that, I guess, like, you have to count Mike Gravel, like a guy that was elected to the Senate in, like, 1960 or something like that. It really is an inspiring cross-section of delusional Americans.
So I need your expert advice on this. As I watch what's developing here with Trump and the White House, the Russia investigation, everything else that's going on, and quite often I think to myself, if this were a movie, well, no one would believe it, but if it were, who would play the various parts? But I want to take a different tack today and say, if we made a movie of this whole thing, who should direct it? And I was thinking, you know, there are some options here. If you get Ron Howard to direct, he's going to play it pretty straight. It'll be relatively close to the actual history. I thought maybe Tarantino, because then you could add some language and gratuitous violence. It could be Christopher Nolan, and somehow the movie ends with Trump leaving office, which would be an interesting take. But maybe Wes Anderson. I don't know. Any thoughts of who might be the best person to direct this bizarre story?
It's a really good question, because I feel like there's several different movies happening within it at any given time. And, you know, there's this sort of, like, ambient gangsterism that defines the broader Trump aesthetic. I was thinking about this reading the New Yorker story about Michael Cohen earlier this week, where all these guys get together and talk like they're in Goodfellas, but they're mostly just like guys that spend a lot of time in hotels. And so they like sort of all the talk of like threatening people and like getting tough or whatever, it mostly involves like sending notarized documents back and forth to each other and like calling your buddy on the phone and being like, somebody ought to beat him up. Am I right? Oh, sorry. I got to get off. Like, my wife's here. Like, that sort of thing. And so I think there's a Scorsese element, but
oh, yeah.
Abel Ferrara was a guy that came to mind just because he's a completely maniacal New York dirtbag. And I think we'd get like some of the, like if you're making a Michael Cohen movie, I would want Abel Ferrara to direct it. If you're making a Trump movie, Scorsese is the guy that Trump would want to direct it.
Right.
I think in the end, it's probably going to wind up being Adam McKay, right? I mean, because that's like the...
or you bring in Tim Burton so Johnny Depp can play him.
Yes, I mean, I think that Depp would, certainly he would love the opportunity to get a crazy new haircut, at the very least.
Exactly.
And then get some face bloat going. It's weird, though. There is this element of it that I find kind of, it is cinematic, but it's a very hard thing to do on film, because there should be this sort of broad sweep to it. But every time I think about what Trump's actual life is like, or what his executive process is like, I get very claustrophobic, because I think he spends a lot of time indoors, he spends a lot of time watching TV, and a lot of time yelling at people about stuff that he doesn't understand, and then sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't, but he's going to stay upset about it. And then, like, but picture a TV that's always on, sunlight streaming through the windows, there's like an ad on television for, like, you know, some
a reverse mortgage.
You know, that if it like that is a very difficult sort of vibe to pull off, in part because like it's a very uneasy thing to even be watching.
I picture it being in some ways like when my grandparents were still alive, and at whatever hour of the day and night I would go in the house, they would be sort of half asleep with an episode of Murder, She Wrote on.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And I wish if someone... This is the thing that, like, I feel, you know, there's a lot of things that I feel regretful about the way the last few years have worked out. But if Trump had just gone up or down one station on the dial, if it wasn't Fox, right, if he was just like into, like, there's a network where people just are constantly, like, flipping homes.
Yes,
right?
Sure.
Just like so maybe he watched that. And then we're fine. And he's less upset all the time. And doesn't talk about like invading hordes. He just talks about like stomps.
Just imagine.
That would be a very blessed timeline.
A simple click of the remote and the world could be a very different place.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be that different. Just one extra push of the button, and yet here we are.
There you go. That might be your book right there when all of this is said and done.
Yeah. Be the alternate history of Trump getting really into the Food Network. Getting like a Guy Fieri haircut and put a bowling shirt on.
Yeah, let me introduce you to my Secretary of State, Bobby Flay. He's a great guy.
Unbeatable. I think that would be great. I think, honestly, like, I think if Trump, even if he were just exposed to more Southwestern flavors in a Bobby Flay style, I think it would help things for him. Instead of it just being piles of mush.
No question about it. David Roth, thank you for helping us get into the weekend. No better way. Always great stuff. We appreciate you being with us. Hope your weekend goes well. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
It's David Roth on The Best of Downtown. When we return, singer-songwriter Al Stewart on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since 2005, Pineland Farms Dairy has been making the finest cheese in Maine. Our cheddar, Monterey Jack, Pepper Jack, Baby Swiss, feta, and cheese curds are all made with natural milk from Maine. Find Pineland Farms cheese at Hannaford supermarkets, Shaw's, Whole Foods, and other great shops throughout Maine and New England. Visit online at pinelandfarmsdairy.com. Maine cows, Maine milk, Maine cheese, Pineland Farms.
Don't feel like making dinner tonight? Don't worry, Angelo's Pizzeria's got you covered. With locations in Bangor and Hamden, Angelo's is never too far from where you are. Pizza made from the finest ingredients and fresh dough, sandwiches, and subs. Calzones, pasta, chicken, burgers, salads, and more. You can find something for everyone in the family at Angelo's. Give them a call at 942-5553 or stop in at 499 Hammond Street in Bangor or 102 Main Road South in Hamden. That's Angelo's Pizzeria, open daily from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor. Don't have to hear too many notes of that song to know it was a monster hit from 1977 for our next guest. On The Best of Downtown, we're talking about Scottish singer-songwriter Al Stewart.
On a morning from a Bogart movie, in a country where they turn back time, you go strolling through the crowd like Pete DeLorean contemplating a crime.
Well, as we found out in our conversation with Al Stewart, the song wasn't even called Year of the Cat in its first incarnation, but we learned a lot. Certainly that Al Stewart is more than Year of the Cat or Time Passages or Song on the Radio. Interesting stories coming up about Yoko Ono, Paul Simon, and more as we talk with Al Stewart here on The Best of Downtown.
I was, oddly enough, midway through writing a set of lyrics, and it got away from me, but I see it on the calendar.
All right. I hope I didn't interrupt the creative process here.
Well, I've covered 2.5 pages of lyrics here. I tend to write too many words. I think I could pause for a moment. I think I know where I'm going with it, so I can probably pick it back up again.
All right. Let's begin, if we can, Al, by going back to the very beginnings. You've been playing music a long time, and you began as a rocker, but I understand that you took some inspiration in an interesting way from Bob Dylan, both as a songwriter, but also because of, dare we say, the quality of his singing voice.
Yes, I did begin when the Beatles happened in England. I think probably almost every other kid joined a band. I mean, there were eight, they were called beat groups in those days, and there were about 80 in the town that I lived in. The problem was, I mean, I joined one just like everybody else, and we would play Twist and Shout three times a night and Wipe Out and all these things that were popular. And eventually I got a tape recorder, and I was, I don't know, 17 or something, and I was beginning to write songs. And I taped myself, and I sounded awful. And the other problem was that, you know, you had to play the guitar. And within a couple of years of that period, you had Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and all those people. And I couldn't really play the guitar well enough. I couldn't sing either. And then I made the mistake of looking in the mirror, and I did not look like Elvis Presley. didn't sound like Paul McCartney. I mean, the whole thing was a disaster. I mean, I was 17 years old, and the only thing that I truly loved in life was, you know, this music. And I realized I wasn't very good at it. And that's a crushing blow, you know. I mean, it's like if you only have one thing in life that you love and want to do, and you realize that you're really not any good at it, it makes you want to throw yourself off a building, I think. So at this very moment, who should come along but Bob Dylan? And I bought his first couple of albums, and you know, he sang like a farmhand, and this was absolutely wonderful because he wrote like you know, a great poet. And I thought, well, you know, there's another way to crack this thing. It's a dilemma, but it can be done. Maybe it can be done, you know, by writing lyrics. I mean, it had never occurred to me before because rock and roll is, you know, it's visceral. It's all about the sound. It's about the beat. It's about being young and enthusiastic, and Dylan's singing, I don't know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, or Masters of War, or these things, and they're very long, and they're very complicated, and it's done just, you know, with a handful of chords, three or four chords. Musically, it's incredibly simple, but lyrically, it's incredibly dense. So I did a complete about-face, and sold my electric guitar, and went up to London, and started singing, being a folk singer in coffee bars. And I thought I would do it for a while and see what it was like. And at the same time, I was auditioning for different bands. I auditioned for a band called the Paramounts, and they turned into Procol Harum, but I didn't get the job. So that's it. I became a folk singer by default. I found myself living in an apartment with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel at one point, and that was really helpful because I was watching how Paul wrote songs, and I thought, oh, that's how you do it, you know. And I met Bert Jantz and people like that from the early folk scene. And in the beginning of 1965, I basically was still trying to join rock and roll bands, and I thought the folk thing might be, it might be an interesting sideline. But by the end of 1965, I had sold my electric guitar, and I was a folk singer, and that was it. It changed my life. And it was all because I couldn't play or sing.
You came out with your first album, Bedsitter Images, 1967. Now, you also worked with Yoko along the way before she and John Lennon even knew each other. Is that right?
Yeah, I met both of them before they knew each other. It's an interesting thing. I'd met John Lennon briefly backstage at a Beatle concert, and he was very nice. He let me play his guitar. I think it was 1966, I was in London, and I met Yoko Ono and became a co-producer of one of her movies, Film Number 4. If you actually look at it, I don't think anyone has seen this. It's such an obscure thing. But I think I'm still listed in the credits as a co-producer. And anyway, I started hanging out with Yoko because I had a tape recorder, and Yoko was, you know, beginning to do her projects, her musical projects, and so I could play the guitar too somewhat. So I would tune the guitar to modal D and start playing Indian ragas, and Yoko would chant over the top of it. And this went on for, I don't know, 6 months or so. We did it, you know, maybe a couple of times a week. And I ended up with like about 6 hours of Yoko and me. And then, as I say it, one day she met a man with a bigger tape recorder. This, of course, was John Lennon. And after that, I didn't see her again. So, that was an interesting period of my life.
We're talking with Al Stewart here on Downtown. Next to music, another great passion of yours was history, and you brought those two together in 1973 with the album Past, present and future, and found this wonderful niche that really was not being filled when it comes to historical songwriting?
No. It of course, it goes back to you know, through thousands and thousands of years. It probably is the earliest form of songwriting. People would write about people would write about the Peloponnesian War, and then they would travel around ancient Greece from village to village singing songs about the heroes of the day. And it fell out. It was like that for a very long time. And then it fell out of favor, I think, in the last century. And, you know, historical ballads disappeared, but they were always there up until that time. So it's not something I invented. It's just something I revived. And I think people have developed shorter and shorter attention spans and tend to write in, you know, very limited hieroglyphical ways. And I think back, a century ago, maybe a little more, women, well-bred women would get up in the morning and they would spend 2 hours composing letters. And these letters were absolutely beautifully done. I mean, the choice of language was wonderful if you read them now. And the calligraphy was wonderful. And, they're small masterpieces. And this entire writing style has vanished from the modern world. It just isn't there anymore. And people use shorthand to communicate with each other, you know, over cell phones. And there's something about that period and the periods immediately before it, which is immensely appealing to me. I mean, people joke that I write my songs on parchment by candlelight with a quill pen. And it's half true that I do. I mean, I mentally do that, and I think I would actually enjoy doing that. It's just that things aren't written that way anymore. Anyway, so I decided I would write historical songs, and I would bring back some of the drama of yesteryear in the writing style.
Well, and the first song of yours that I was drawn to as a young man and was from that album was Warren Harding. How did you come to write a song about one of our, well, let's just say, least effective American presidents?
Well, at some point in my life, I had studied all the American presidents, and I discovered that I found the bad ones more simpatico, really, than the good ones. I always actually enjoyed, the bad ones because some of them were so crazy and, as you say, ineffectual. I mean, I like Franklin Pierce. What can I tell you? I mean, he's the only one that looks like a rock star. He kind of looks like an older Brian Ferry.
His
little quirks. And Warren Harding, you know, presided over Prohibition, so the song actually is partly about Prohibition, and it's partly about, the crazy life and the untimely death that he had.
A couple of years later, you teamed up with Alan Parsons for Modern Times. What was that collaboration like?
Well, it was it came about very quickly. We were having dinner in a restaurant, and Alan is very understated, and we were talking about wine, because that's what we always talk about when we get together. And I believe that we were drinking a 1966 Chateau Palmer. I mean, I have an almost photographic memory of every bottle of wine that I've ever drunk and with who. Anyway, that is by the by. And during the course of discussing the Palmer, I said, I'm making a new record. Would you like to produce it? And it took about 5 seconds. Alan thought about it, and he said, oh, all right. And then we went back to talking about wine. It was really that simple.
Well, the song that, of course, exploded on the scene here in America, although it was never a hit back in England or in the United Kingdom at all, was Year of the Cat. Now, am I right that when you wrote that song originally, they were completely different lyrics?
Yeah, one of the things I do, because I write so many words, I've written 2.5 pages of lyrics already today, and it's only 10 o'clock here, so I just write lots of words. So think about a blues player. Think about a lead guitar player in a blues band. What you do is they make the backing track, you know, the bass, the drums, keyboards, whatever, and then the guitar player goes out into the studio, and he'll make, 10, 20, 30 passes at the solo. The producer listens to all the different things that he's done and picks the ones that he thinks is would be right for the song, would be the great guitar solo. So a musician will do that. A musician will do, you know, lots and lots of passes at the music, trying to get something perfect or something special. And how I work is exactly the opposite way. We knock out the backing tracks. We did the whole of the Year of the Cat record with no lyrics. Literally, I hadn't written them. We just went in and we recorded, I don't know, 40 minutes of music. And I took all the tracks home. And then I would write, you know, I'd get up in the morning and I would write different sets of lyrics to everything. So some of those songs had three or four completely different sets of lyrics. Or if a song had four verses, I would write 12 verses. And then I would weed through it and throw away the ones that I didn't, you know, particularly like. And oddly enough, I go back and look at them now, and I probably chose all the wrong ones. But there are, yeah, I mean, there's an entire set of lyrics for Year of the Cat called Foot of the Stage, about an English comedian. And I'd seen this comedian shortly before he committed suicide, and I knew something was terribly wrong. The audience were laughing because they thought it was all part of the show. And so I wrote this song, and it went, "His tears fell down like rain at the foot of the stage," and that's what it was called. And then somewhere along the line, I had a girlfriend who had a book on Vietnamese astrology, and it was open at a chapter called The Year of the Cat. So I just watched the Casablanca movie, so I launched into a completely different set of lyrics, and wasn't sure which one to pick. But the American record company said, "Well, we've never heard of this English comedian, so let's have it Year of the Cat." But it could easily have been Foot of the Stage. I mean, I have alternate lyrics for tons of different songs. You know, it's just how I work.
Now, is it true that you weren't crazy about the saxophone that was added to the song?
Well, I just didn't think a saxophone belonged in folk rock. I mean, folk rock to me is, you know, guitar, bass, drums. You know, it's... that's what it is, you know. And a saxophone to me was a jazz instrument, and I didn't think it belonged in a song in that style. But Alan convinced me that it was a good idea, and of course it was a good idea because people like it. But I still, you know, I was doing jangle folk rock, you know, like the Birds, Simon and Garfunkel, and saxophones just seemed like out of place with what I was doing. But obviously, you know, I guess Alan was right about it.
Well, Year of the Cat was hugely successful, as was the follow-up album, Time Passages. Was there any sense to you or the producers or the record company that you needed to make radio-friendly songs after the success of Year of the Cat?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it brought out a little devilish impulse in me because... Clive Davis, who was the head of Arista Records that released Time Passages, had more or less decided that this is what we should do. We should, you know, have mid-tempo ballads with saxophones on them. And if we did this, we could keep doing this. They would make the charts. And I found this very distressing. I mean, I wanted to go back to writing my historical songs, and I wasn't at all sure about all this pop star business. It seemed a little, I don't know, it just seemed a little shallow to me. So in order to annoy Clive and get him off the subject, I actually literally wrote a song to be played on the radio and called it Song on the Radio.
Knowing, of course, that radio people are so vain that we will play anything if it's got radio in it, even better if it's a good song.
The stupid thing actually made the top 30. It was a minor hit. But that was just me being, I don't know, it was me trying to, you know, sort of get out of all of this, really. And then, of course, I got myself deeper into it.
Well, you went on to make up more albums that were, I think, in keeping with your musical sensibilities. And one of my absolute favorites came out in the mid-90s as a history teacher and a lover of history. One of my favorite albums of yours is Between the Wars.
Yes, I like that. I was kind of influenced by Django Reinhardt a little bit. Mm. I was, at the time, I mean, I tend to live in different periods of time on different days. I'll wake up and spend the whole day in like 1648 or something, and it just, you know, I'll just be there. I won't be in the modern world at all. And at the time I was in the 30s, I was reading a whole series of books by Alan First, who's a brilliant writer who sets most of his spy novels, really, in the 1930s, most of it in Eastern Europe. And so I was knee-deep in the 1930s and started writing these songs. And before I knew where I was, I had an album. And because it was all set between the wars, that's what I called it.
You continue to tour extensively. You've also got a wonderful DVD out live at Carmel by the Sea and a chance to reunite with old friend Peter White.
Yeah, I that DVD, I don't really know much about that. I had a friend who had a camera. I mean, it's not really a very professional thing. He just set up a camera and recorded the show. And because I don't play with Peter that often anymore, you know, I thought the fans might like it. So somebody put it out.
And you'll also be here in the East. It'll be good to have you here on the right side of the country.
Well, you know, I play everywhere all the time. I mean, it's shocking to me. I mean, I thought that, I tell you, when I was at school, when I was 17, that my parents and my school teachers gave me a stern lecture about, you know, about music and about trying to make a career in it. And they said the whole thing was a fad and it would be over in it would be over in 6 months. And I thought, well, I've got to leave school immediately. If I'm only going to be able to do this for 6 months, I'd better get started. The incredible thing was that the advice they gave me coincided exactly with the release of the first single by a group from Liverpool called The Beatles. So they could not have been more right. It would be technically impossible for all the adults in my life at the time to have been more wrong. I mean, they were just completely 180 degrees wrong about everything. So here I am half a century later, and I'm still doing the thing that they said would only last 6 months. And there's something absolutely divine about all of this. I have a couple of children, and I'm absolutely resolute in not giving them any advice whatsoever, because all the advice I got when I was young was wrong.
Well, we're very glad it was, and we're still enjoying the music all these years later.
Yeah, well, I'm writing about the Siberian dilemma at the moment. Do you know what that is?
Well, I'm not sure. Which Siberian dilemma?
Oh, there only is one as far as I know, and it's this. Periodically, you know, when the springtime, when the ice begins to melt over the freezing water, people fall in. They fall through the ice, and they fall into this very, very cold water. And the Siberian dilemma is this. If you fall in, you are going to freeze to death in basically 1 minute. I mean, that's it. You've got 1 minute to live. But if your every impulse you have wants you to climb out. But if you do climb out and you're soaking wet in the freezing air, you die in 30 seconds. So the Siberian dilemma is, do you stay in and live a little bit longer, or do you try and climb out? And this is what I'm trying to write about at this very moment.
I can't wait to hear the finished product. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see. I've covered 2.5 pages, and I'm not done yet. So,
well, we'll let you get back to it. Al, thank you so much. We wish you continued success and good health.
Thanks.
Oh, good stuff there from Al Stewart. Fun conversation with him. Our thanks to Al, as well as David Roth of Deadspin and Tom Baudet of NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me. That'll wrap it up for us for this morning. Thank you for making us a part of your day. Have you done something nice for your bride on Mother's Day, Carrie?
I have encouraged my daughter to do something nice for her. I'm not exactly sure what those plans will turn out to be, but I have faith.
It's Mom's Day, but I know you're the kind of guy who makes it Mother's Day all year round.
Well, yes.
Don't need one of these greeting card-inspired holidays?
I used to do a little bit more. Now I just, whatever my daughter is doing, I support and
try not to get in the way.
Put some funds towards the effort.
Go. Very nice. Well, a happy Mother's Day to your mom or whatever moms are important in your life. And hope you'll join us tomorrow. Good stuff on the program as we'll talk with Alan Adams of The Main Edge and get movie reviews on Pass the Popcorn. Jen McCaffrey of The Athletic talking Red Sox. Emma Wilson introduces us to more Top Gun entrepreneurs and more good stuff next week, including writer-producer Josh Karp, the man behind A Futile and Stupid Gesture, wonderful Netflix movie about the early days of National Lampoon, and the producer of the terrific documentary on Orson Welles called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. Plus Bill Berry, NASA historian, Adam Savage of Mythbusters next week, actor Barry Pearl from Grease, and much more in the week ahead on Downtown. We'll see you next time right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be